Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
And thanks for joining me today. This is Andrew Horowitz, and we have a very special episode. This is an interview I did with Jim O'Shaughnessy, What Works on Wall Street. Great guest, great opportunity to spend some time with one of the really brilliant guys in this area of investment management and knowledge about not only history, but what really does in fact work on Wall Street. This is the interview. As I promised, we're here with James O'Shaughnessy. Jim O'Shaughnessy, he is a national bestseller writer. He has books called What Works on Wall Street. He is a well-known, very well-respected money manager, and I am so glad to have you on. This is your fourth edition, huh?
Yeah, the fourth edition. This one's a lot bigger than the third edition, so it's a lot more to get through.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, it's thick. But, you know, the thing about your work is it's not just all heavy reading, because a lot of it is tables and information and exhibits, right?
Exactly. You know, what we've tried to do with this book is we've really done a lot more research. For example, this time around, we're doing sector-level analysis, and we've added lots of factors. We also have data now going back for certain factors to 1926. Mm. So there's a lot of additional stuff in here. But we tried to design the book so that people didn't have to read it all the way through. So, for example, if you're a value guy, you can read the first four chapters sort of why things work the way they work, explaining kind of how we're programmed to fail as investors. That looks at both behavioral economics and neurofinance. And then you can go to the value chapters and you can say, okay, wow, I didn't think about this. Maybe that could be good for me. And if you're a growth person, well, you just go to the growth chapters.
Yeah. And what you have here is, for example, each one of them says, okay, well, what did this grouping of stock do, whether it's the high or low price to sales, high or low PE ratio, or whatever else the subject is. And then, you know, what's the Sharpe ratio, what's the risk, what's the dynamics per period. So it's kind of all really laid out very nicely. I have a couple of questions for you. First of all, you know, actually, I remember something. One of your first books that I read, it got me kind of hooked on some of this, and I went out and I emulated the data stream of information that you had. I think it back at the time was Standard & Poor's research, like data stream or data set.
Yeah,
or something
Standard & Poor's CompuStat. CompuStat. Was the basic.
Yep. Yeah. I bought that. That was a lovely investment, actually. It was great. I don't know. Yep. I use Bloomberg now, but back then.
We still use CompuStat. We also have augmented it with, for historical research, the Chicago Research and Security Prices, or CRISP data set, which goes back to 1926. We also use MSCI, WorldScope, mm-hmm. and Bloomberg. So we've got them all.
So now, some people like Jeremy Siegel go back and they look at things like, you know, back to the 1800s. Is that really something that we can, you know, really, you know, hang our hats on?
Well, you can. We've got some data sets from well-known academics like Jeremy and some folks up at Yale, where you get really good price return to, say, 1870s. You know, prior to the 1870s, Roger Ibbotson has done a lot of work mm-hmm. that tries to recreate the security prices back to the founding of the New York Stock Exchange.
Right.
It's very admirable, very admirable. But one of the things we have to remember is that, you know, in many instances, we're looking at five bank stocks, or we're looking at, you know, a handful of railroad stocks. So I think that for the purposes of trying to determine which investment strategies work the best, you really are kind of limited to 1926. And, you know, it also brings up a really good point that people should keep in mind when they're looking at the results, is that, you know, not all of the stocks that traded are included in these data sets.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is there could have been a whole host of stocks that didn't do so well, that didn't get included in the data set.
Right.
So, you know, take all research that is historical research with a grain of salt. I think once you get past like 1950, the level of detail in the information is quite good. And the database really does cover virtually every stock that was trading. Prior to that, it offers a really good indication, and it certainly should be studied because it gives you a really good sense for, you know, what could be the worst case scenario, for example. You know, one of the things we cover in the book is exactly that. What were the worst case scenarios for a strategy or a factor going back sometimes to 1926 and in general to 1963? Gives you a really good sense that, you know, markets don't go straight up. But also, you know, that markets, like we've experienced for the last 11 years, are kind of anomalous.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, what happens afterwards is pretty good things.
Well, one of the things, did you do any studies, for example? I know a lot of the things that you've done are something like, well, let's just talk about one that I've written about in my book, too. It's like the dogs of the Dow, as an example.
Yeah,
you know, what,
sure.
You know, you buy at the beginning of the year, you know, rotate it back at the beginning of next year, and then you kind of go along with that. Now, have you done any studies that talk about, like, for example, a rotation based on another factor, such as maybe some kind of sell stop or some kind of other indication of the market?
Oh, yeah, we've done a lot of those. Dogs of the Dow is one that I took back to the founding of the modern Dow Jones Industrial Average when it became a 30-stock index in 1928. We've done even further studies on a broader group with the CRSP data. And we've studied things like selling when there's a 50% loss, selling when it falls out of the top percentile or decile, rather, of by dividend yield or whatever factor you're looking at. So one of the things that we found sort of as a net result of that is some of the sell stops work very nicely, but you'd be surprised. You don't want close-in sell stops. We tested 10%, 20%, et cetera. You really don't add a lot of value until you really extend that to a 50% loss.
Wow.
And I think, I was very surprised. I was very surprised. And I think one of the reasons for that is there, in the day-to-day movement of even well-known stocks like those in the Dow, there's a lot of up and down. I mean, just look at the market over the last couple of months. 3% and 5% days up and down are not unusual.
Yep.
And so when you move that down to the individual stock level, one of the things that you find is stocks bounce around a lot, and investors need to understand that and sort of be able to stay the course. So one of the things that we found is that for most investors, for most individuals who are making their own choices and buying their own stocks, they're probably best suited to the annual rebalance of a portfolio. And, you know, just from a psychological point of view, and of course, this is really difficult because do-it-yourselfers tend to be really interested, right? So they check it every day and they look at what they're holding. Probably bad for the performance of your portfolio. You're better off if you check less and or at least change less.
Right.
You can check as much as you like, but if you kind of have, and if you're a taxable investor, one of the things you can say is, you know, I really want to hold this and have a long-term gain, not a short-term gain.
Right.
Try to keep yourself honest that way. It's very hard psychologically, though. I mean, we have two chapters in the book that cover why it's so hard to be a successful investor. And, you know, one of them was written by my son, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, chapter 3 on neurofinance. Basically, what's happening, it's a brand new field, and what they're doing is doing these super fast scans of brains making decisions under uncertainty. And what they see when they look at the scan of the brain is that it's the emotional centers of the brain that are firing, not the logical centers of the brain. So it's really like we are wired to fail because we get so emotional about what's going on in the short term that we make the wrong choice at the wrong time. And of course, that's borne out in the data. When you look at the Dalbar studies and you look at a variety of other stuff, looking at, you know, people's trading decisions, Terry O'Dean, who's an academic at the University of California, did a huge study, and what he concluded was the more people traded, the worse they did.
You know, it's interesting because on one hand, I hear what you're saying, I get it, you know, and I understand the emotional part of it, but some of the components of the market valuation is on what people value a stock at, and that not one person, but the entire mass. So.
Right.
You know, I've always criticized, and I just had a conversation with somebody a little while ago about this whole discussion of, oh, stocks are cheap according to PE and all that. And I'm like, wait. There are a lot of other things that we need to put into it. That's just the easiest thing to convey, you know, the
right.
To look at. And but PE, why is the PE of the stock market this on this date and that on that date? It doesn't only have to do with the earnings part of it. It has to do with people are willing to pay for it. And that's
no question.
And that's a function of, we don't want to say emotion, but it's a function of their own interpretation of the data that's out there and what they're going to pay, which is, again, personal preference en masse.
Yeah, there's no question about that. PEs expand and contract based not just on people's expectations and what they're thinking about the future, but also on demographic data. I mean, when you look at the number of, say, middle-aged investors versus young investors, when there are a lot more young investors, PE tends to expand, right?
Right.
And so when there's a lot more middle-aged to older investors, PE tends to contract.
Right.
And the reason for that is pretty simple. You know, when you're 65, you start selling parts of your portfolio to live on. And when you're 25, you want to invest and make as much as you can. And so there's a lot to those numbers too, but you're absolutely correct. You can't look at PE as frozen and say, if this, then that, because you could be in an environment where there are, demographically speaking, PE is going to contract rather than expand. You could also be in a period where people are just unduly pessimistic.
Yep.
One of the things we found, though, is that one of the reasons why looking at valuations, not just PE, but things like price to sales, even at enterprise value, things like that, it does offer a good clue, because what we see is investing when people are really, really pessimistic mm-hmm. tends to yield the best results.
Right.
In other words, they don't stay pessimistic forever, right?
Right.
And particularly if in times like right now, in the introduction in the book, we look at the 50 worst rolling 10-year periods, again, back to 1870, using some of that data we got from a Yale professor. And what we found, we weren't so interested in, you know, how bad things were, and they were bad, you know, and just by way of example, the 10 years ending February 2009 were the second worst 10-year period since 1870. The first was May of 1920. So basically, we living through really bad time, 10-year period. But what we did then was we said, well, what happened 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, and 10 years later? And what was fascinating was once you got to 3 years after these horrible 10-year results, 3, 5, and 10-year results for the next, you know, the ensuing 3, 5, and 10 years, no negative numbers. All of the returns were positive and quite strongly positive. And it gets you back to, of course that's the case, because what happens after one of the worst 10-year periods? You get people incredibly pessimistic
right.
about the prospects
right.
For the future, and things start getting really, really cheap, and dividend yields start going up, and, you know, wonder of wonders, the next 10 years tend to be good.
Yep. As a matter of fact, I think, if I recall correctly, I think it was you who coined the phrase sappy slugs, wasn't that you?
That's right. It was.
It was you.
Boy, that goes back.
Yeah, it goes back because I put that actual piece and an example of an alternative to the dogs of the Dow, which is that.
That's right.
In a way, in my books, I said, you know, this is a really good thing to look at because it's more than just the dogs of the Dow, which are the highest dividend paying. I have a question for you, and you could answer this because something's been bothering me for years, and that is the change in the makeup of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which used to be an industrial average, if you will,
right,
and
right.
used to be mostly, if not all, dividend-paying stocks, and therefore you do a dogs of the Dow, and you have, let's say, 30 out of 30, and you get to pick and rank and all that on the yield. But now we have probably four companies that don't pay dividends or something like that.
That's right.
And
yeah.
does that, you know, they'll never be included in that. In the dogs of Dow.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a really good point. And one of the, I think, legitimate criticisms of the dogs of the Dow is, hey, your data set in 30 stocks is too small. You need to cast a wider net, like you said, the sappy slugs, which looked at the S&P 500. Or even if you've got access to a bigger database, you know, all big companies. One of the things we've also found, though, in terms of dogs of the Dow, one of the things that we did to see if we could get better returns was to look at actually what we call shareholder yield, which is the dividend yield plus any net buyback activity that the company is engaged in the prior year.
Mm-hmm.
So you get that by simply looking at shares outstanding. So if there's 100 shares outstanding a year ago and there's 90 shares outstanding now, that company has a buyback yield of 10%. Right.
Right.
And then if it's got a dividend of 3%, that would give it a shareholder yield of 13%. We found that actually worked better than just pure dividend yield when you're looking at the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
Mm-hmm.
And it also gets you over the stocks that don't pay dividends. Right.
Right.
A lot of those stocks, instead of paying dividends, you do huge buyback programs in the market. There's more than one way to get cash back to shareholders, and buying it back in the marketplace is one of those ways.
Yeah, I hear you.
So
yeah,
that works very nicely.
You know, just as another point, we also here, we subscribe to a couple different theories, but one of them, we do trade a lot in some of our accounts, but that's a different story. I mean, it you know, whatever floats whoever's boat it is.
Right.
But I do agree with you also that emotional trading, as a matter of fact, you have a chapter here, and it's entitled The Persistence of Irrationality and How Common Mistakes Create Tremendous Opportunities. This is page 37. There's a table here that talks about the chance of positive returns on an S&P 500 portfolio from 1980 to 2009. And
right.
it talks about, but then you also adjust it by an emotional adjusted average pain reward score. You know,
yeah.
How much pain and how much torment is someone willing to take on a position, and then what happens, and it drops it down dramatically.
Yeah, well, absolutely. That's like my earlier point about the more you look at it and the more you revisit it, the more painful it becomes if things aren't going your way.
Right.
And conversely, the more aggressive and, in quotes, greedier you get when things are really going your way.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we found is that, you know, the persistence of irrationality is something that is baked into the system. So when people would often say to me, well, good Lord, why would you publish these results? Why would you let people know what works well and what doesn't work well? And my answer has always been the same, because people are always the main part of the equation, right? And they say, you know, people are what determined security prices back in the railroad boom of the late 1800s, right?
Right.
They are what determined prices when, you know, when RCA shot up 600% because it was a brand new technology.
Mm-hmm.
People haven't changed. We still react exactly the same way. In that same chapter that you're referring to, chapter 3, we look at the chart of the South Sea Trading Company that was a huge bubble company. It is not Isaac Newton's time. And then we show a chart of the NASDAQ in the tech boom.
Mm-hmm.
They're identical.
Yeah.
They look exactly the same.
Right.
So people basically haven't changed. We let, you know, I always say that the four horsemen of the investment apocalypse are fear, greed, hope, and ignorance. And if you think about it, only ignorance is not an emotion. Fear,
right.
Greed, and hope have wiped out more money than any bear market, because people's persist in their irrational behavior. And really, we kind of look at the way we invest, which is systematic quantitative investing, as arbitraging human nature.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because you talk about ignorance. You can make a lot of money being ignorant. I seriously,
yeah.
I'm not kidding. You know, if you just, I sat, this is going back way many years. I sat behind these two, in front of these two guys that were talking about AOL the whole time of this hockey game. AOL. And I'm like, this is the early days on. I'm like, AOL, what is that? What is that? And,
yeah.
You know, we said, oh, you know what? We'll take a look at it. We looked at it real quickly and said, you know, it's interesting. Let's take a little piece of it. Well, I can only tell you, right? And then, for
right.
example, people will buy an Apple stock because they have an iPod, not knowing anything more about the company or not, but they like the product.
Right.
That's ignorance, if you will. I have a question for you. This may be a little more technical again, but you're the guy to ask this. Now, one of the things that really bothers me, it's one of those pet peeves, is the continual share buybacks that are goosing EPS on Wall Street. You know, so you have a buyback that happens and everybody gets excited because the company's standing behind their stocks, creating a floor. But more importantly, that the company will now have less shares on the market and their EPS does not adjust on a ratio basis or per.
Right.
So is there anybody that ever tracks a repurchase adjusted EPS to keep everything nice and clean? Because it really is not clean.
No, I know it's not. And, you know, we haven't seen any external data providers that do things that way. I think you could probably do it if you were adept at Bloomberg and Excel and adjust it for yourself. My guess is that it's not going to make a huge amount of difference. One of the things that we were able to test, you know, back to 1926 is this concept of buying the decile with the highest buyback.
Mm-hmm.
And it does very, very well.
Right.
And again, it makes a lot of sense. You know, we also test in the book for the first time all of the various accounting ratios. And one of the ones that really proved the best at telling you which stock to avoid was what we call external financing. In other words, how much of a company's operation is being financed through external sources like issuing stock or issuing debt. And, you know, if you'd bought the decile of companies that had the highest use of external financing over the last 45 years, your return, your nominal return, not your real return inflation adjusted, but your nominal return was a loss of 0.06% per year.
Hmm.
Now, that's during, obviously, some of the biggest bull markets in history.
Right.
So the idea is pretty simple. You know, companies that are using a lot of, issuing a lot of shares or buying or issuing a lot of debt, generally toxic. Companies that are, on the other hand, standing behind their company and their shares and buying shares in, very, very, historically,
and that makes
been
sense.
A very good approach.
That makes sense. I mean, one of them is cannibalizing their own capital. And diluting the company on a regular basis, basically to pass through. It's almost like an annuity where they give you the interest and your principal back, right? And you drain it out over time. And then the other one is really just a pure stream of revenue generated by what they do. It's awesome. So, yeah, that's good stuff.
Yeah.
I would recommend this. This is, I mean, really, just if you go and check this book out, there's just a wealth of information in here. Just again, as Jim said, you know, you don't have to read the whole thing because there's things that may not be applicable, but you know, you look at a relative price to strength and where it's going to be and, you know, the combining value factors with a single company. So I guess the question I have to ask you is, at the end of the day, which one is your favorite particular strategy? If you had to narrow it down and throw away all your other children, which one is the best, you know, your favorite strategy that you say, you know what, at the end of the day, if I had to, that's the strategy I'm going to go with.
If I had to, I would go with either. Well, it depends. Is it a conservative gym or is it an aggressive gym?
Yeah, both. I'll give you two.
Both.
I'll give you two choices.
Okay. So if it's conservative me, I'm going to go with the strategy that buys market leading companies with the highest shareholder yield. Remarkable strategy, does very, very well in big, well known, financially sound names. Doesn't have the heart attack factor that you get from more aggressive strategies.
Is that ROE? Is that ROE you're talking about, or is that
no? It's the chapter on finding the best value strategy.
Okay, I got you.
And essentially, what it does is it uses the composited factors that we build in the book and discuss.
Mm-hmm.
So looking for very financially strong companies, for example, companies that don't have very high external financing,
right.
As an example.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great conservative strategy. Now, for a great aggressive strategy, I would use the strategy that we develop in searching for the greatest growth stock strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a strategy that looks for companies that are reasonably priced in terms of their value factors, but that have great price momentum.
We call that GARP. GARP?
It's not quite GARP because GARP has more to do with what the PE alone is, and
it's
looking for a forecasted growth rate and earnings that's higher than the PE.
Right.
This is pure cheap stocks on the mend, so to speak.
Mm.
These are companies that are very, very cheap, and yet their price momentum has turned around, and over the last 3, 6, 12 months have done very, very well. Great strategy, compounded at over 20% over the last 45 years.
Wow.
Very volatile, though.
Yeah.
I mean, let me stress that for everyone listening.
Right.
It is not a strategy for the faint of heart, and it tends to be a smaller cap strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to keep those things in mind, because as we were talking earlier, you know, people get emotional about things. They really want to keep, when they're reading that chapter, pay close attention to the worst case scenarios.
Right, and don't do it during the market hours, because it gives you you may get that urge to just do it. So
exactly.
Right? Do it after
wait
market
till the market's
hours.
Closed.
James O'Shaughnessy, author of What Works on Wall Street, the fourth edition, the classic guide to the best performing investment strategies of all time. A beautiful book, well done, lots of information. I want to thank you for joining me. It's awesome to finally get to talk to you.
Thanks a lot. Great to talk with you.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.